November 10th, 1989. Former Chancellor of Germany, Willy Brandt, addresses the media after a night of celebration. His iconic statement fuels the hopes of many Germans for a unified nation.
Now, we find ourselves in a situation where things that belong together are growing together once again. This applies to Europe as a whole. The winds of change sweeping across the continent could not bypass Germany. None of us knows exactly what the next stages would look like at this moment. Nevertheless, this is a wonderful day, one where many people who have been separated, especially families, can finally reunite.
Brandt's words became synonymous with Germany's reunification, achieved just 11 months after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the German Democratic Republic. Peaceful protests had dismantled a regime that had oppressed its citizens for nearly four decades. The rapid fall of the Iron Curtain stunned the world, especially West Germany's government. Chancellor Helmut Kohl and his administration were unprepared, and a plan for a potential reunification was missing. Kohl and his government had to scramble to figure out a way to integrate a previously socialist nation of 17 million people into the prosperous country that had risen to the top ranks of the world economy after the Second World War. Dr. Hanno Hochmuth, executive manager and research fellow at the Leibniz Center for Contemporary History in Potsdam, recalls how the desire for reunification amongst many people in the GDR began to put pressure on the government in the weeks following the fall of the Berlin Wall.
When we have a look at the year 1989 and 1990, it's very interesting how a specific slogan changed. When the power of the SED, of the Communist Party, was not yet broken, the protesters had this famous slogan, "We are the people," which meant "We are the sovereign." But soon, already in December 1989, it changed into "We are one people." So that was the idea of reunification of Germany that came into the minds of the people together with high expectations to reunify with a strong West German society. And when the East German people had the chance to vote for the first time freely in their lives, for the first time in decades, in March 1990, the majority of the people voted for the parties that promised the quickest reunification. And so it happened.
After the celebrations of November 9th came the sobering reality of transformation. Politicians, bureaucrats, and citizens all grappled with the monumental task ahead.
Just a short while ago, astonishing news from East Germany.
This is the middle of the checkpoint. The police are making no attempt to stop people, and thousands of people are pouring over to take a look at a West. In
some private travel outside the country can now be applied for without prerequisites.
Die neuen Bundesländer in blühende Landschaften gestalten.
They shout, "Die Mauer muss weg, the wall must go." Thousands and thousands of West Germans come to make the point that the wall has suddenly become irrelevant.
By the late 1980s, the prospect of German reunification seemed distant. Global leaders had shown little interest in resolving the post-World War II division of Germany. The absence of a peace treaty and unresolved border issues left both German states under limited sovereignty, governed by the Allied powers. While the GDR was economically and militarily tied to the Soviet Union, West Germany was part of NATO and thrived within the global free market. Enjoying a comfortable lifestyle and a strong economy, many West Germans had made their peace with the division of the country. The events of 1989 rapidly changed the situation. The fall of the Berlin Wall on November 9th also caught Chancellor Kohl off guard. At the following Monday peace protests on November 13th, one of the main slogans shifted from "We are the people" to "We are one people." Most of the protesters no longer protested for reforms in the GDR, but rather for German reunification. Faced with mounting political instability in East Germany, Kohl and his government needed to come up with a solution quickly. On November 28th, after consulting US President George H.W. Bush, the German Chancellor presented his 10-point program for overcoming Germany's and Europe's division to the German Parliament.
We are also prepared to develop confederative structures between the two states in Germany, with the goal of creating a federation, meaning a federal system in Germany. However, ladies and gentlemen, this necessarily requires a democratically legitimized government in the GDR. What a reunified Germany will ultimately look like, no one knows today. But I am certain of one thing. Unity will come if the people in Germany desire it.
Kohl's plan proposed creating confederative structures as a pathway to reunification while emphasizing European integration to appease the leaders of other nations. Both Margaret Thatcher and François Mitterrand harbored deep reservations about Kohl's plans and openly voiced their concerns at the prospect of a strong reunified Germany. Tensions were high. The United States, on the other hand, were in favor under the premise that Germany would remain part of NATO. In the months that followed, Helmut Kohl worked tirelessly to win the support of Germany's European neighbors and Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. Gorbachev insisted on guarantees, including the neutrality of a unified Germany. France's initial apprehension gradually eased during a series of high-level meetings. President François Mitterrand saw an opportunity in German reunification to bolster European integration and pushed for the accelerated creation of an economic and monetary union in Europe. And even Margaret Thatcher began to soften her stance after an intensive two-day meeting with Kohl in Cambridge on March 30, 1990.
As far as the United Kingdom is concerned, we may need to adapt our commitment under the Brussels Treaty so that we can make some reductions in the level of British forces in Germany. Although I believe the needs of collective defense will require us, like the United States and France, to keep sizable forces there. But there must be no doubt that Germany will be a part of NATO. This offers the best security for Europe as a whole. Your strong and categoric assurances on that essential point, Chancellor Kohl, have been a tremendous encouragement. I'm going to set out tonight briefly some proposals which could make that summit a major step towards the creation of a great alliance for democracy, which would stretch from the Atlantic to the Urals and beyond.
At home, challenges for Kohl's administration kept piling up. One of them was the daunting task of how to deal with unifying the German currencies. This was inevitable, since one of the slogans of the peaceful revolution in the GDR was, "If the Deutschmark doesn't come to us, we will go to the Deutschmark." Deciding on an appropriate exchange rate between East Germany's Ostmark and West Germany's Deutschmark was no easy task. Economically, an exchange rate of 8 or even 10 Ostmark to 1 Deutschmark would have been realistic, reflecting the Ostmark's true value. But Helmut Kohl argued that this would create a divide between East and West Germans. Instead, a political symbolic decision was made. Starting on July 1, 1990, for a limited time, citizens could exchange an average of 4,000 Ostmark at a 1-to-1 rate. Any amount beyond that was converted at a 2-to-1 rate. Salaries and pensions had already begun being paid out in Deutschmark at this conversion rate starting on May 1st. In total, 431 billion Ostmarks were exchanged for Deutschmarks, 62 billion at the 1-to-1 rate, with the remainder at 2-to-1. Even behind the Iron Curtain, East Germans knew about the products available in the West. So when the borders reopened, East Germans spent their new currency on Western goods that had been out of reach for so long. The ensuing spending frenzy in the West had a devastating impact on the East German economy. Dr. Hanno Hochmuth, executive manager and research fellow at the Leibniz Center for Contemporary History in Potsdam, explains the profound hardships this transition imposed on the local population.
So about 80% of the East Germans did either lose the job permanently or had to change jobs. So this process, it was a very massive process in terms of the work relations, and that was very, very important for East Germans, because all their life before 1989 in the GDR was basically based on the work. So the children went into the kindergartens that belonged to the workplaces. The sites where people made holidays usually belonged to these people's own companies and so on. So losing the work also meant losing a meaning of life in a way. So this was for many people a quite tragic experience, even though they didn't fall into very bad conditions on a social level, because the West German social system was applied in East Germany. So the majority of East German people was caught by the social network that was introduced in East Germany as well. But the feeling about personal pride connected to the idea of working in a working society, the GDR was a society based on work, really made something with the people and created some big problems and big feelings of unsatisfaction.
Even today, Germany continues to wrestle with these issues. Many East Germans are still dealing with the economic consequences that followed the fall of the Berlin Wall. The currency union, with its chosen exchange rates of 1-to-1 and 2-to-1 between the Ostmark and the Deutschmark, had devastating consequences for local Eastern German industries. Unable to compete in the international market, many products from the former GDR disappeared from the market. Alistair Birch, an IT expert who worked as a consultant for the German government between 1990 and 2000, vividly recalls these effects.
I don't think people were quite aware how inefficient East German industry was. Like, I grew up in England, and in England, all the cheap cameras were made by Praktika, which was an East German company. And they made lovely cameras. They weren't high-end by any spec, but they were the cheap ones. And anyone who was starting out in photography bought their first camera was almost always a Praktika camera. They had about 25% market share. But that market share vanished when currency unification was done. And of course, that currency was worth basically between a fifth and a tenth of the East German currency, because it was done on a one-to-one basis. The Praktika cameras basically for export suddenly became 5 times or 10 times more expensive, and the market vanished. So there was no time for the industry to adjust. And so a lot of these businesses, even though they were profitable businesses making a product that people wanted, still went out of business, because suddenly you can't cope with your prices going up 500% overnight.
To deal with those struggling formerly state-owned socialist enterprises, the German Democratic Republic established an agency in June 1990 called the Treuhand. While intended to manage the transition to a market economy, the Treuhand quickly became a target and was blamed for the hardship many East Germans endured in the years that followed.
One particular institution that was created to run this process of reunification was questioned especially strong, especially high. That was the Treuhandanstalt, the agency that was put into place to transfer these formerly people's own companies into private companies. And most of this time, this meant that these former people's own companies were sold for little money to West German companies, or they were closed by this Treuhand agency. So many, many people criticized this Treuhand agency and had this notion that it was just created to sell out East Germany and its economy.
Alistair Birch, who was directly involved in the post-reunification integration, admits that there were significant trade-offs that Treuhand represented. But he points out that there are also arguments and positive examples for the decisions at the time.
The skills were still there. Like, if you look in the town where the Trabant was made. Yes, Trabant was an awful car, and it went bust very, very quickly after currency unification. But that's where Volkswagen is. That's where the other cars, car manufacturers are, because they recognized there was a skilled workforce in that area. And so when they built their modern factories and invested their money, they knew they'd have workers to hire. So it wasn't all bad. There was transition. There is industry in former East Germany. It's just different industry, and I do recognize that the actual change, as abrupt as it was, really did impact some people, perhaps more than it would have done had they done it slower. But if they'd somehow introduced capitalism more slowly, then maybe these Western companies who came along, like Volkswagen, wouldn't have come there, because the skilled workforce would already have moved away. So apples and oranges. I think the best was done in the circumstance. I think it wasn't perfect, but it was the least bad option that they chose.
Meanwhile, in West Germany, concerns about the enormous financial costs of reunification began to grow. At the same time, East Germans were grappling with economic decline and uncertainty. Facing these pressures, Helmut Kohl, who was running for re-election, needed to secure strong support for his government. During a campaign stop in the summer of 1990, he offered a promise he knew would be difficult to fulfill.
I'm more convinced than ever that in 3, 4, or 5 years, we will turn the new federal states into blooming landscapes.
In December 1990, he would go on and win the federal election with a clear majority, with significant support from the newly formed eastern states. While Helmut Kohl faced countless challenges within Germany, his government achieved a diplomatic milestone on the international stage. The 4+2 agreement, formerly known as the Treaty on the Final Settlement with Respect to Germany, is celebrated as a shining example of international diplomacy. Signed in Moscow on September 12, 1990, the treaty brought together the former Allied powers and Germany, paving the way for reunification as a sovereign state. The treaty established that United Germany would join NATO, with Soviet troops withdrawing from East Germany by the end of 1994. To ease Soviet concerns, it was agreed that only German NATO troops could be stationed in East Germany, and Germany's military would be limited to 370,000 soldiers. Germany also renounced the possession of atomic, biological, and chemical weapons. These points were a linchpin in the negotiations with Russia, but Washington managed to persuade Gorbachev with a package of incentives. So on October 3, 1990, just 329 days after the fall of the Berlin Wall, Germany became officially reunited. This date marks the German National Day. After the speeches and fireworks finished, the Federal Republic of Germany was still in a period of enormous transformation. Integrating institutions, auditing bureaucratic data, and managing the traces of the former East German state required the help of experts. Alistair Birch, an IT consultant who moved to Berlin in 1990, was one of them. Over the next decade, he worked on various projects for the German government. His biggest task was assisting the Gaukbehörde, tasked with managing the files of the feared East German secret police, the Stasi.
The biggest task we had was at what was known as the Gaukbehörde, or BSTU. They were based in the old Ministry of the Interior, the Innenministerium in the center of East Berlin. And their role was to give everyone who wanted access to their Stasi secret police files. I mean, the Stasi didn't exist anymore. All the people had been fired. They actually passed some very restrictive laws saying if you ever worked for the Stasi in either as a staff member or as an informal spy of the Stasi, you can never ever work in the public sector in Germany again. So in order to implement that law, they needed to know who had cooperated with the Stasi, but it was beyond that. A lot of victims of the Stasi, or people who thought they were victims, wanted to read their files. So they passed a law saying everyone has the right on request to read their Stasi file. And the Stasi knew they were being disbanded. So before they were walked out of the buildings, they actually destroyed all the index cards. They didn't touch the files because that was protected. So all the files were still there, but you couldn't find anything at all. I mean, you had no idea what was in what file. They were just given numbers. So essentially, we wrote a computer program. We didn't computerize the files themselves. That was considered too dangerous because that would make the files kind of permanent. And a lot of the information in there was of dubious quality anyway. They're, you know, not everything the file said was correct. So what they did was they indexed them on the computer. So if, you know, Frau Müller from Leipzig then submitted a query, we could look up and say, hey, there's a file about you in Berlin. There are several files that mention you in Leipzig. There's something from where you grew up in Halle. And the BSTU was then able to bring all these files together. And then Frau Müller got an invitation to come in and read her files. And that was all done using the computer program that we wrote for them.
For many East Germans, accessing Stasi files came with risks. Discovering betrayals by friends or family members could destroy relationships beyond repair. Beate Olbrich, a participant in the first wave of protests in 1989, recalls how her aunt reacted after reading her Stasi files.
She was just shocked because the person she was convinced would be spying on her, you knew somebody would spy on you. You just knew that. So she thought the person that would do that would be her ex-husband. No, it was her best friend. And that's sort of, she's like, you know what? I mean, it changed, obviously, that friendship forever. But even then, she said, oh, my God, it's all over now. We all moved on. We all have our lesson. And she I think there's a sense of it doesn't matter anymore. Like, I know that people on my friends have been working for Stasi as EMs. Why ever, I don't know. I have a friend that her dad worked for them. It's okay. It's all over. I'm certainly not holding a grudge. But then again, I didn't have the worst experience. I think there's people that had much worse experience and they probably will tell a different story.
Other East Germans like Ilona Prindable chose not to look at their files, leaving the past in the past.
Other friends looking at their files got the big surprise that they found out, for example, that their own brother was spying on his sister. I decided I don't want to know. I don't want to see it. That's the past. I want to leave it in the past. For me, basically, that file is closed.
Living under an authoritarian civilian state created an atmosphere of paranoia and fear. However, after examining the extent of the Stasi's records, Alistair Birch discovered the surveillance was less pervasive than many GDR citizens imagined.
But only about 10% of the population actually had a Stasi file on them. And so we did actually get complaints. We had people who had applied to see their Stasi file who were convinced that everything that bad had happened to them in East Germany was to do with the Stasi. And we looked and we checked everywhere and we came back to them and said, sorry, there isn't a file about you. And so we had people complaining, oh, there must have been because, you know, this, that and the other. And of course, they went back and checked. But no, most 90% of the population didn't have a file. The ones who did, though, they really were followed. There were cases where there's one particular famous case where a woman read her Stasi file and found out that this guy had been paid by the Stasi to befriend her at college, to report back on her activities, and actually got to know her really well. She'd married him. He was at home with their two kids while she read this file. It was a very sad case. And then, of course, she went home and threw him out on the spot. There were other people who were just locked up because of their political beliefs or because they tried to leave and go to West Germany. It was for the people who suffered from the Stasi. It was not a pleasant place to live. The people who weren't involved in politics, it was maybe more comfortable.
The Stasi files were only one challenge among many. the Treuhand agency, established to privatize East Germany's roughly 8,500 state-owned companies, also oversaw the sale of 2.4 million hectares of agricultural land and forests, along with numerous government properties. Re-establishing rightful ownership of houses, apartments, and estates proved to be not an easy task. Alistair recalls his own experiences living in a Friedrichshain apartment, which was in desperate need of repair.
The building I lived in Richard-Sorger-Straße in Friedrichshain in Berlin, it was administered by the local property agency, but no one knew who it belonged to. And so what happened was the gas company came along and repaired or basically refreshed the gas mains in the street outside. And as part of that, they had to disconnect all the houses. They redid the gas lines, which took about a week, reconnected the houses. But at that point, as part of standard safety procedures, they needed to test that the house system was safe before they reconnected to them the gas. Of course, these buildings hadn't been touched in 40, 50 years. None of them was the gas safe. So right in the middle of winter, they essentially disconnected an entire street. We all had no heating, no hot water, no nothing. It'd been going on for 2 weeks and no one knew who the buildings belonged to. And so there was no one to pay for the repairs. All our rent that we'd been paying at that time was being put into a holding account, waiting for the eventual owners of those buildings to be sorted out. Of course, that doesn't help you. If you actually search on YouTube, you'll find a video of a very young me talking to the local TV news. I got all my neighbors together and we created, you know, press day. And they had all the cameras using our house as an example of buildings that were in emergency administration and the fact that we had no heating and no hot water in the middle of winter. Of course, being in the press, it got the attention of the politicians and they did find an emergency fund to repair our gas. And then the whole street ended up getting fixed as well. And that was put against the mortgage of the building. So there was money. It was just people didn't know how to access the money. And we accelerated the process. The important thing was it was necessary to go building by building and say, OK, what are the competing claims on each building? Who used to own this building and when was it confiscated? Because sometimes it was confiscated in under Nazi Germany and then maybe the building was sold. It was confiscated again under communism. Sometimes it was confiscated multiple times. Sometimes the building had been demolished and streets had been realigned, and maybe what was a building that your family used to own it now was now part of a tram network. And in East Germany, they never really used to bother about property rights, so they didn't always update the property register. So there could be multiple competing claims on different pieces of the land, different parts of the building, and essentially, this authority collected all the claims together. If there was a simple one-to-one, they handed the building back. Otherwise, if there were multiple people who all had valid claims from different periods of German history, they basically said, OK, we're going to compensate all of you. We're going to sell this piece of land and distribute the money on proportionately based on your claim. It was very important because then at the end of it, there was a clear owner of the building and the building could then be renovated. If you walk down Richard-Sorger-Straße today, all the buildings look really, really nice. They've all been done up. The facades have been fixed. The balconies have been fixed. These are really, really nice buildings. That would never have happened had we not done the fundamental work, which is to establish who owns each building. Because if you don't know you own the building, you're not going to invest in it either.
When the Treuhand ceased operations in 1994, it had accrued a debt of 270 to 300 billion Deutschmarks, approximately 860 to 900 billion Australian dollars. Its privatization efforts often led to closures and job losses, fueling resentment among many East Germans. Alexandra Feig, a journalist who grew up in Saxony, remembers the implications for many families in the former GDR.
Almost all the companies from the GDR time were closed down as well. So very suddenly, a lot of people had no job. So they were forced to search for work somewhere else, and it was mostly in the western part of Germany. And I can give you the example of my dad. So he lost his job as well, and he was forced to travel to Bavaria, which is a neighboring federal state to where I'm from, for the next 20 years, meaning that he wasn't home Monday to Friday, and only came back for the weekends. And that's, yeah, pretty tough, though, if you don't have your dad around during the week. And, yeah, I mean, and then you try to spend as much time as you can in the weekend. But there's also this tension of he feeling guilty about not being there, not helping my mom, you know, being alone with two kids during the whole week. And then, yeah, and then, you know, housework and all those things that come along with this. But it was necessary because you have to pay your bills at some stage. And that meant you had to search for work. And he was trying to find work back where we come from, at home, if you like, quite often, but he was not successful in finding it. And then later, after those 20 years perhaps, he was like well regarded in the job he had in Bavaria, and he earned a lot of good money. And then he got offered a job back home, which was a like similar job he had in Bavaria, and they would only have paid him like half of the wage. So he kind of reached a stage where you well, you know, I probably don't want this anymore. We found our rhythm here. We found a system as a family to work with this, with Dad being away. And this is just one example, but I can tell you there's so many other families there. For them, it was just the same.
Many East Germans sought a fresh start in other parts of the country, but not all found success. Tensions between East and West Germans began to slowly emerge, as Beate Olbrich records.
In the East, there was quite a big separation to start. Some people who left, I was one of them, and people who stayed behind. And people who stayed behind for many, many years just got really robbed by their jobs, by their security, by everything they knew. For example, my dad had a really good position when he came and applied as a 50-year-old man and applied to work in West Germany. He was laughed at because the profession didn't exist. You can't be an economist from East Germany. Like, come on, you see what's happened to the country. So all these things that you were proud of once, and that was your life and your savings and the plan you had, that was all gone. It just didn't exist. And not only that, but you also got laughed at. You've been taking the mickey off. You know, the accent is funny and they all eat bananas. So you started, I think then it started already that people got a little bit like, no, hang on, we're not stupid and we don't want to be treated like that. Each time I came back to Berlin, I was now living in Aachen, each time I come back to Berlin, I couldn't recognize anything anymore. All the streets' name had changed. The names of pubs where I would be going or clubs, everything had changed. Everything had to be stripped. And I didn't like that. A lot of people didn't like that. Even in the way, this is history, just leave it be. That's, we called it that street and we called it that name. And of course, prior, everything East was not good no more. We had to reinvent the recycle system, which worked actually really well in the East, really well. And little things like this, everything that was for food we had, was nothing was good anymore.
Looking back, it's clear that mistakes and misjudgments were inevitable. The German government had to integrate a collapsing socialist system of 17 million people into a free market economy in less than a year without any blueprint. They were basically making it up as they went, but their decisions had huge implications for the lives of many, many people. And there was no turning back. The fall of the Berlin Wall marked the end of nearly 40 years of oppression under a ruthless regime. Günter Wetzel, who famously fled the GDR in a self-made hot air balloon in 1979, understands the frustration in some that had it tough after the reunification. But he still believes it was a momentous step forward for Germany. He shares his first impressions upon returning to the East 500 days after the wall came down.
Mein erster Eindruck war eigentlich entsetzt.
My first impression was actually one of shock, because I had grown accustomed to the image of the West by then, where everything was nicely done up and modern. I went across and it was a foggy autumn day. The streets were all broken. I drove through this first small town. The walls were grey-black and there was still the stench of lignite smoke in the air. I was genuinely shaken by what I saw. After that, I travelled to the GDR regularly, and by the end of 1990, I began working as a sales representative, spending, I'd say, 95% of my time in the new federal states. I was able to witness and contribute to the development in the new states right from the beginning. And I have to say, it's simply incredible how things turned out, that Germany came back together, and that people who had once belonged together were reunited again. No one had experience with a situation like this. Of course, it was somewhat naive to believe that everything could be equalized in a short time. But in hindsight, I have to say it was still a success that it happened. Sure, there were challenges for some individuals. Not everyone was able to immediately experience the positive aspects or view the situation in a positive light. But the majority of people I got to know were happy that it happened. And for those who put in some effort, they were able to build a new life. Many succeeded. In the West, in the new system, the reality was that you had to take initiative if you wanted to achieve something. But if you wanted to achieve something, you could do it. I'm convinced of that, because I went down that path myself and saw it happen with others as well.
For many, the reunification of Germany opened doors to new opportunities and freedoms, while for others it brought loss, disillusionment, and a lingering sense of being left behind. But more on that in the next episode of Mauerfall. This was the second episode of SBS Audio's Mauerfall, 35 years of freedom and transformation. Produced by Benjamin Kantak, sound design by Max Gosford, and production oversight by Joe Supple. Thanks also to SBS German. For more episodes of Mauerfall, follow on the SBS Audio app or wherever you listen to podcasts.